Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. From top cop to ex-con, former New York City Police Commissioner Bernard Carrick says the U.S. prison system is broken. His career in law enforcement spanned three decades and earned him numerous awards, including a nod from President Bush, who nominated him to lead the Department of Homeland Security. Instead, revelations of tax fraud and corruption landed him in prison for 3 years. Released in October of 2013, he says the American criminal justice system is broken, and he uses his unique perspective to advocate for reform. Bernie Carrick, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're visiting Penn State. You gave a talk at the Penn State Forum today titled "The Urgent Need for Criminal Justice and Prison Reform in America," which is quite something coming from the man who ran two of the largest law enforcement organizations in the country and who also spent 3 years behind bars. From your perspective, what's wrong? Why is the U.S. criminal justice system in dire need, as you put it, of reform?
I think first and foremost, we are incarcerating people that don't need incarceration to learn from their mistakes, to pay their debt to society. It's an enormous economic cost to the country that I think the American public doesn't understand, nor do many of the legislators that implement these laws. I think we have mandatory minimums and sentencing guidelines that are punishing people way farther than what they need. I think we're destroying families. We're destroying the economy. And let me be clear, bad people that do bad things belong in prison to protect society. Violent people, that we have to keep away from society for society's sake, they belong in prison. There's a need for prison, but we have evolved into a society where our mentality is anybody that does anything wrong under any circumstance, the only way to punish them is prison. And if we continue down that road, it's unsustainable financially. It's unsustainable socially. You're going to destroy families, destroy children, and destroy our society as we know it.
You say that prosecutors and judges really have no idea what the federal prison system is like, and that you didn't know. And you write in a white paper that you wrote in 2011 while you were in prison that it's sad to say that nearly everything I believed about the federal prison system when I was New York City's police and correction commissioner has been contradicted by my own incarceration.
Because you don't know. Nobody knows what it's like to live as an inmate until you're there. Because you haven't been there, because, look, I ran Rikers Island. I had 133,000 inmates.
The biggest institution in the country.
One of the biggest jails in the country. One of the most violent at one time. And I thought I knew all about jails and prisons. But you know nothing until you have been an inmate. And you learn what it's like to be infused with institutionalization, to worry about MRSA and staph infection and HIV. Even in a minimum security camp, you
are
treated.
Which is where you were in Cumberland, Maryland.
Which is where I was. You're treated as an animal. You are degraded, demoralized, demeaned constantly. And we believe, for some reason, society believes that's a benefit to society. When you're taking young men and you're putting them in prison for 10 or 15 years for a small amount of cocaine, 5 grams of cocaine, you lock them up on a conspiracy charge, we believe that's a benefit to society. Well, in reality, that kid's going to be in jail, in prison for 8.5 to 12 years. He's not going to get the education he needs. He's going to be a convicted felon. He's not going to get a good job when he gets out. He's not going to get a job, period, when he gets out. He can't rent an apartment. He can't get any kind of job that's regulated by the government. And the only thing he's going to be able to do is return to crime. We force that upon him instead of possibly getting him treatment, instead of putting him in a program where we can erase that conviction. We don't do that.
The only way to erase a felony conviction is with a presidential pardon.
A felony conviction, the only way to erase it is a presidential pardon. The chances of that happening, I'm going to wind up on the moon next week. It's not happening.
Second chances is something you talk about. And in fact, President George Bush played an integral part in your life after this very long and in some respects glorious career. He enacted into law the Second Chance Act in 2008. You say, from where you're sitting, this notion of a second chance is BS.
There is none. A felony conviction, especially a federal felony conviction, is a life sentence. It's a life sentence.
How so?
Because you are a convicted felon until the day you die. That 18-year-old kid that gets picked up on a low-level first-time nonviolent drug offense, if it's a felony conviction, if he lives to be 120, he's still a convicted felon. He still will have certain voting rights that he can't have. He'll never be able to access, possess, own a firearm. You lose enormous civil and constitutional rights that you never get back, ever, ever, ever. Well, that's not what the Founding Fathers wanted when they created our justice system. You're not supposed to be punished for life. You're not supposed to have personal annihilation. You're supposed to pay the punishment for your mistake or your crime and then go on, but that doesn't happen.
Do you feel like you're still paying for the crimes you pled guilty to?
Of course, I'll pay for the rest of my life. And here's what's horrifying to me for the majority of people that go through this. I have been far more blessed than many. I had a house to come home to. I had a family to come home to. I had things to come home to. You have no conception how many people are in prison and have nothing to come home to. And then we hold them accountable. It's an impossible circumstance. But our senators, our congressmen, our state legislators, they have no clue. Nobody's looking at the collateral consequence of the conviction.
Well, speaking of no clue, while you were in prison, you wrote a white paper about this dire need for prison reform, and you sent it, your observations about what's wrong with the system, to U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. His office never acknowledged receipt of that paper, and so I'm wondering, do you know if he read it? And who's listening to your calls for reform?
I know they got it because it was sent certified. I don't know his office got it. It didn't bother me as much that we didn't hear or I didn't hear whether he read it or not. I sent that paper to 92 senators, congressmen, and the United States Sentencing Commission. I got one response.
From whom?
Barbara Mikulski.
Well, interestingly, not only did you send it to all of those people, but you actually testified before Congress. You're a registered Republican, and not a single Republican showed up to hear what you had to say. Only Democrats were in that room. What do you make of that? What message were they trying to send to you?
It's not what they're trying to send to me. And this is the scary thing. It's what they're doing for their constituents. This is a national issue. This should not be a Democratic or Republican issue. I know a lot of these Republicans, these senators and congressmen. They're good guys. I know them. They're my friends. But the bottom line is this system is broken. Privately, they will tell me I'm right. They know I'm right. They know what the problems are. But they are scared to do anything about it because they look soft on crime. You know what? That's stupid on crime. That's stupid for this country. We have to fix this system because if we keep going down the road we're going, economically it's unsustainable, socially it's unsustainable. People that do bad things, that are bad people, they belong in prison. But we are putting thousands upon thousands of people in prison that could pay with alternative sentences, community service. Why isn't there 100 times more community service things going on than we have?
In fact, you talked about doctors who were in the prison where you served, who were there for tax violations.
They're there for tax violations or billing violations, federal billing violations. Okay, I get it. They did something wrong. They did something wrong. Fine them, penalize them in some financial way. You know how many communities in this country need doctors and we don't have them? Put those guys to work 15 hours a week, 20 hours a week. You're going to work and you're going to give back to society. You're going to pay your debt to society. What do we do? No, we don't do that. We completely annihilate them personally. We stick them in prison and they sit there and twiddle their thumbs. In fact, I found it so horrendous, even in the BOP, in a federal prison, if there was some major problem, illness, sickness, a guy broke his leg one time, the doctor's there. Don't touch him. You're not a doctor here. Dude, he is a doctor. He's a really good doctor. Why aren't we putting these guys to work? Accountants, lawyers, things like that. They'll take a lawyer, they'll disbar him, they'll put him in prison. We have thousands
of people. It's a lose-lose.
It's a complete lose-lose. Why aren't these lawyers in prison helping guys file motions for appeals? They're not allowed. If they get caught, they get reprimanded. In fact, I think it's a criminal charge for practicing without a license.
Did it really take your being on the other side of the bars to recognize all of this?
Yes, because you wouldn't know it if you weren't there. I ran Rikers for 6 years.
Do you have regrets about some of the policies you personally instituted in those institutions?
You got to remember, my system was a jail system. My average length of stay was only 45 to 54 days. A jail system and a prison system is very different. But I can tell you the things I thought I knew, I did not know. The things I thought I would care about, you just don't know. You don't know until you're there. When you're there and you're living in this world that is completely unknown to you, you then start to see things that you've never seen before.
You say that these mandatory sentences do teach inmates certain things. It's an education in lying and cheating and manipulation. What do you think we should be doing?
Well, first of all, don't put people in prison that don't need it, okay? Don't institutionalize men and turn them into monsters if you don't have to. Commercial fishermen that catch too many fish, you put them in prison for 18 months, 2 years, 3 years. You take their license. They lose their property, their boats. The people that worked on those boats lost their jobs. You take one guy that owned a boat, ran a company, it cost you, the American taxpayers, $2-3 million a year for that guy to be in prison. That's insanity. Find the guy, penalize him.
$2 million because of the collateral damage and
you lose the economic tax loss. You lose the tax loss, the economic spending cost. For all those people, six people that was on that boat working for this guy.
The ripple effect.
The ripple effect. And there's thousands of guys like this in the prison system. You know, we don't do anything to make money. We just annihilate lives, destroy families, most importantly, children.
In fact, you write about that in your white paper, that the collateral damages include the children who might be without a father for 10 years and maybe living on
the
public assistance.
The system contradicts its own mission statement. They want you to be rehabilitated. There's nothing within the prison system that rehabilitates you or helps you. There's nothing. You may get a high school diploma, you may, but as one young black kid, an 18, 19-year-old kid said to me, it makes no difference whether I get a GED or not.
Because I have the
black,
label of convicted felon.
I'm a convicted felon. I'm never getting a good job. Nobody's going to hire me. Now, I can't get anything that I would get in the outside world as a non-felon. And unfortunately, sadly, he's right. He is right. So unless by some miracle these young men get out and they're taken under the wing of somebody else and they become an entrepreneur, they do something on their own, they can't even get a job at McDonald's. They can't get a low-level, menial task job because of that conviction.
What are your job prospects? Here you were, as I said, running two of the country's largest criminal justice systems. You were the commissioner for the NYPD and the commissioner of corrections. What are you doing these days? How are you making a living?
I'm working on my next book, number one. Number two, I'm doing some consulting, some private consulting. But I am nowhere near doing what I used to do. And keep in mind, unless you have some executive, some governor or mayor or somebody in the White House that has the courage to say, irregardless of the conviction, he has these work traits that we need, and we're going to use him, which has never happened because nobody in politics has the courage to do that these days. Without that, I never go back to government.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest is former New York City Police Commissioner Bernie Kerik. His remarkable 30-year career in law enforcement ended shortly after President Bush nominated him to lead the Department of Homeland Security. The national attention led to a federal investigation, which resulted in corruption charges and 3 years in prison. We're talking with him about life before and after prison, about the notion of second chances, and about why he says the American criminal justice system is broken. This interview was recorded October 21, 2014, before the grand jury's decision not to indict Officer Darren Wilson in the Ferguson, Missouri shooting of an unarmed black teen, and before the decision not to indict the officer in the chokehold killing of Eric Garner in New York City.
There are some who say you actually got special treatment. For one, you were sentenced to home confinement. You didn't go to a halfway house when you were released a year early. How do you respond to people who say, why should we listen to Bernie Kerik, number one? And number two, he was treated differently than everyone else.
The people that say I got special treatment, they have no conception what they're talking about for this reason. One, I got 15 months over the guidelines in sentencing. My guidelines were 27 to 33 months. I got 48. I did more time than I was supposed to. I did more time than was recommended by the Department of Probation. That's number one.
Why do you
number
think
two,
that was the case?
It was a judge's decision. Personally, I think it was a political decision, but that was up to the judge. Secondly, my halfway house time, when you come out of prison, there are three things that can happen. You can go to halfway house, you can go to home confinement, or you could split it and do both. I went to home confinement. That's a benefit to the Department of Correction, not to me. In all honesty, home confinement to me is just as bad as being in a halfway house. Like my judge told me one time, if you step out the front door to pick up the paper, you will be remanded. Okay, go home and lock yourself in a house for 6 months, see how it feels. The deprivation of freedom is far more profound than anything anyone could imagine unless you've been through it.
I want to take a step back for a moment because your undoing, you were this rising star, and your undoing really began when President Bush wanted to nominate you to head Homeland Security. At first you said no, and then you said yes, and there's part of me and lots of others wondering, knowing that you did have some things to hide, for example, you did employ an illegal immigrant to provide nanny services for your two young girls. Why did you say yes? And people say you have this attitude of invulnerability.
It's not about that. Here's the issue. I initially said no. It was a financial decision. It was my wife at the time was saying, you promised no more government. You promised you weren't going to do this. You don't say no to the president. And in this circumstance, one, it was something that I thought I could do. And I have to be honest, as arrogant as some people may think I am, there's no doubt in my mind, especially given what I've seen over the last 10 years, there's no doubt in my mind I would have done better in the Department of Homeland Security than anybody I've seen since. So I thought I could do a good job. If you look at my history in the police and correction departments, some of my successes, many of my successes, most are unparalleled.
Well, what's interesting is that President Bush actually said to you, I am choosing you because I want you to go over there and break some China. He didn't ask you policy questions. He didn't ask you. It wasn't a typical interview. But there are conspiracy theorists who believe that you were actually nominated at the suggestion of Karl Rove so that you would be the undoing of Rudy Giuliani, that you would not be vetted. You would not be the head of Homeland Security, and because you were so close, it would be the undoing of his run for president in 2008. What do you make of that?
I think those are the same people that have told me that the World Trade Center attacks never happened, that the visuals of those planes going into the buildings, they were all commercially done and edited.
So you were a serious nominee candidate for the job.
I was quite serious.
What needs to happen here? You say that part of the problem is mandatory minimum sentences, sentencing guidelines. Where do we go from here?
I think it's all about the senators, the congressmen, the legislators, state legislators. They have to realize that the system as it stands today is unsustainable, that the system as it stands today is destroying lives and destroying society. It's not helping it. There is a need for prison, and there is not. I think when we take prison and overpunish and annihilate people's lives when we don't have to, I think that's a problem for us. When we create an economic burden by doing that on society, that's a problem for us. I think there's a much better usage of some of the people that are going into the system, these doctors, lawyers, accountants, and other people, professionals, that can be used in community service. And I think we have to look at what it's doing to our children, the children of those convicted.
How were you able to maintain a relationship with your own two daughters?
It's extremely difficult. And like I said, I am more fortunate than most. My wife was able to come see me once every 6 weeks, once every 2 months. As I said earlier.
Because she had the wherewithal, the financial ability to do it.
I had family and friends that helped us get through this. But there are so many men and women that don't. They don't get to see their kids. They don't get to talk to their kids. You know, you pay an inmate 18 cents an hour to work, but you charge that inmate 23 cents a minute for a phone call.
To talk on the telephone.
You know, I can go to my house right now and get on Skype or one of these other services, and I can call China for 2 cents a minute. But the BOP charges 23 cents a minute for you to make a phone call to your child. 23 cents a minute. There is nowhere in the United States is there a cost like that.
Speaking of cost, what's your view of for-profit prisons, which are cropping up all over the country?
There should be one way that we accept for-profit prisons, and that is if they can guarantee us a reduction in recidivism and increased programs.
Which is about 40% nationwide.
Right. If they can reduce recidivism and they can give us programs, implement programs that we don't do at a cost cheaper than what we pay now, then fine, do it. Other than that, what is the benefit other than paying for this industry? It's an $80 billion a year industry. There are lobbyists in Washington making tens of millions of dollars a year to promote this industry. And then you have...
And you say that many of the contracts stipulate that you must guarantee the contractor 90% capacity in these prisons.
They want a 90% occupancy rate in their facility that they're going to take over for you. Well, if I ran a jail or prison system and I guaranteed somebody a 90% occupancy rate, the only way I could do that would be to break the law. Because there's no way that I could know. I don't have ESP. I can't tell you how many people's going to get arrested or how many people's going to be in the system. And the only way to guarantee it, violate their probation, take away their good time, make sure you keep them inside as long as you possibly can. That is not justice. That's not what the system's created for.
Let's talk a little bit about something that's been in the news quite a bit lately, and that's this idea of bias-based policing. We read, it seems, every week about an African-American or a minority who is shot and their crime is not wearing a seatbelt, and things escalate. In fact, you had a situation like that when you were with the New York City Police Department. A 22-year-old West African was shot when he was reaching into his pocket. The officer believed he was pulling out a gun and it turned out to be a wallet. What's behind this problem in your opinion? How do we solve it?
Well, I think today one of the problems is, you know, the press and the media focuses on some of this stuff and it sort of gets exaggerated. The problem is these cops work in high crime areas, for example. It's difficult to criticize the police officers, for me, unless you've been in their shoes. I've been involved in gun battles. I've had partners that have been shot and killed. My own partner was shot and I wound up shooting the guy that shot him. Every cop responds differently. You had the recent event at Ferguson where a young man was shot who was unarmed. We have a tendency in this country, it's getting worse and worse every time there's an event where we prejudge everything. Let the investigation take its course. Let the grand jury do its investigation. Let's see why the officer shot. Let's see what happened before he shot. People want the officer hung. They want him convicted. They want him sentenced. They want him in prison. They have no clue what happened yet. Time will tell.
How do we get rid of bad prosecutors and bad cops?
Bad cops you get rid of. Bad cops you get rid of. You'll catch them, you'll find them, and you'll get rid of them. Bad prosecutors, you rarely get rid of.
Why is that?
Because there's no accountability. Bad prosecutors, they have to do something really bad and get caught. You know, they can have selective political prosecutions. They suppress evidence. There's a whole bunch of stuff. All these judges, be it England or the other judge out on the West Coast recently, starts with a K, I forget his name, they're all talking about the Brady violations, the suppression of evidence, all this stuff going on. But these guys are still working.
You know, it's interesting because you can see case after case of someone who spent maybe 10, 15, 20 years in prison, and they're exonerated. And when the story comes out, you realize that there was prosecutorial misconduct, and nothing happens.
We just had it in Brooklyn. He got 30 years. 30
and he was innocent.
Years for a homicide, was just released, wrongful conviction. But if there's anything I can tell you, Patty, that people should think about, here's something to just think about for a while. We hold congressional hearings for federal agents that go down to Colombia and have sex with women. We hold congressional hearings to see if the Nielsen TV ratings works. We have congressional hearings if some sports figure takes enhanced performing drugs.
Interesting.
But there are thousands of people over the last 10, 15 years, thousands, that have been sentenced to 10,000 years in prison, wrongfully convicted. And there isn't one damn hearing. Why? Why? That's what people should be asking. This is, in my opinion, the greatest country in the world. We have a democracy and a constitution that is better than anyone else's, and we are stomping all over it. Why aren't there congressional hearings about these wrongful convictions and people taking freedom away from American citizens? I don't know.
You say that our failure to fix this problem comes at our own peril, and in fact you compared it to a fast-growing cancer, eroding our democracy and much more. What's the solution here?
Our legislators have to have the courage to do the job they're sworn to do. That's the solution. They know it's wrong. They know what it's doing to society. I know they know. They tell me. They admit it. They know it. Do your job. That's all. If you worked for Walmart.
And Americans need to quit demanding tough on crime.
You have to be smart on crime. Tough on crime? Tough on real crime. Put bad people to do bad things in prison. But somebody that enhances their income on a mortgage application, you put them in prison. It's a financial crime. Most of them don't even know they're doing something wrong. Some kid that sells a whale's tooth on eBay, you put him in federal prison. Commercial fishermen that catch too many fish, all those low-level, first-time, nonviolent drug offenders that could really get a second chance if they were put in a program and you dismiss their conviction so they didn't have a felony conviction, that's smart on crime. That's smart on crime. It's smart for society.
And on that note, we're out of time. Bernie Carrick, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was former New York City Police Commissioner and ex-con Bernard Carrick. This interview was recorded October 21, 2014, before the grand jury's decision not to indict Officer Darren Wilson in the Ferguson, Missouri shooting of an unarmed black teen, and before the decision not to indict the officer in the chokehold killing of Eric Garner in New York City. For more information about Bernie Carrick's advocacy for prison reform, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.